Happy Saturday. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. I've got a special show for you today. We're going to spend about 10 minutes, and I'm going to tell you about some of the pieces which are moving rapidly on that three-dimensional chessboard I've been kind of bringing you up to speed on the last three or four shows. Our geopolitical enemies, Russia, China, and Iran. Our ideological enemies, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Muslim extremism, radical jihad, and the economic battles, which are now rapidly taking shape, including with our friends China. And we're going to talk a little bit about some tax stuff, and we're going to talk a little bit about some immigration stuff, but it's going to be pretty brief. Next week, I'm going to be getting into all these topics hot and heavy, because they are all interconnected, folks. That tax check you just wrote on April 15th, unless you extended, that tax check is being used in various nefarious ways you need to know about. And it's all tied to the decline of the dollar, the assault on the dollar by the BRIC countries, Russia, China, etc. It's going to mean huge impacts to you and your family and your pocketbook in the coming years. And just to give you a feel, did you know that if you are making around $75,000 a year, your share of the interest on the debt, $10 trillion of which has been rung up by Mr. Obama in the last 6.5 years, you're paying $4,000 a year on that debt. That's right. That's your share of the national debt, folks. $4,000 for interest. And that is at interest rates that are about zero. Think about what your share of the debt's going to be when, A, the debt continues to increase on purpose, and, B, interest rates go up. And they will. Well, and then I'm going to talk to you about, and this is probably, well, it's by far the biggest. I think it's the coolest part of the show. How many of you know what April 19th is? Do you know what April 19th is? Come on, search your memories. Think about your history. You know, the touchstone of the past is the guidepost to the future. April 19th is the day that the shot heard round the world was fired. That's right. The battles of Lexington and Concord. The beginnings of the Revolutionary War. That's Sunday, folks. That's tomorrow. In 1775. I'm going to tell you that story. I'm going to tell you in some detail. I think you're going to find it fascinating because, you know, we have kind of this peripheral view of what happened that day. And when you get into the details and you find out about the orders that were given on both sides, the unintended consequences that set in motion, really, a great nation and changed the course, not only of the geopolitical structure of the world then, but obviously the planet Earth and mankind forever. Pretty amazing stuff. I think you're going to be fascinated by the story. I'm going to wind up telling you a little bit about the audiobooks on Threads West, which are coming out here in the next week or two. We are so excited about them. They are absolutely fabulous. They're read by Jack Baer, one of the foremost voices in the country, along with some others who are involved in the films, etc. And I will tell you that they rock. And we're going to have them both in physical form, that's right. It's one of the first times ever done, so that you can carry them with you, plug them in anywhere, listen to them, or you can download them at Audible, CD, Babies, etc. We're going to have a big release. Stay tuned to the website, threadswestseries.com. Also some great special pricing on the audiobooks there. Book one's coming out now. Book two is just getting finished up. Book three is close on the heels. And they'll be starting on book four, too, which hopefully will be coming right out right after the print release, which, of course, with the last 3 months wrecking a truck and having the house blow up water-wise, which is still a mess, is slightly behind, not to mention the vagaries of the book industry. But it's coming, as is 5 and 6. Well, look, let's get started, because I really can't wait to get into the story of the shot heard around the world. That's right. It is quite a story, and it's part of the story of us. It's part of the story that leads to the story of Threads West. But first, let's talk about the three-dimensional chess game very briefly, kind of in bullet point form, shall we? Let me tell you that this week's been kind of a wild week on the planet Earth. I don't know how much you followed it. You've probably been following the big stories, but let me tell you, there's a lot happening just underneath the big stories, which are every bit as important. There's a lot happening on the periphery, which nobody's reporting on. That's my job. Number one, you know, we have Mr. Obama, who released 5 Taliban generals for Bergdahl, who's now turned out to be the deserter that Obama always knew he was, i.e., the report that is now surfaced from 2009. Yet we don't have an Obama who doesn't want to leave anybody behind in the field, you know, doing anything to get out Mr. Amir, the Marine in Iran. I don't know if you know about that at all, but there's a number of Americans, 3 or 4, being held in Iran. FBI agent that nobody's heard about, pastor Amir, a former Marine, served several tours of duty in Iraq, Persian-born, went over there to visit his grandmother, was nabbed by the Iranians. They've held him for 3 years. The Obama administration has done nothing. Zero. They can trade 5 Taliban generals for a deserter, and they know he's a deserter, but they can't get one Marine out of an Iranian prison while they're negotiating their nuclear arms deal. How about this? How about you walk into the table the first day and you go, you know what? You want sanctions lifted for $30 billion a year? You're starving. Your economy's falling apart. We ain't talking to you about nothing until 1 hour from now, we know that guy's on a plane. And if 1 hour from now he's not on the plane, we're out of here and you guys can go to economic hell. How about that for a negotiating tactic? It might just be effective. You're damn right it'd be effective. But, of course, that's not the intent of those negotiations. The intent of those negotiations, if you listen to my last few shows, I think you will agree irrefutably, is the intent that Iran get the bomb. That's what our president, Valerie Jarrett, his closest advisor, and born in Tehran, Iran, and a Muslim, that's what they want. Okay, then we have Russia flexing its muscles, cozying up to Iran, helping them with missile technology, which has been taken off the table in the negotiations. I mean, hell, let's let them build a missile that can go 3,500 miles, shall we? And we have the Obama administration getting a concession from Congress in their vote, overwhelming vote, that they have to have a say in this nuclear deal treaty. Not that I trust their negotiating skills any better than Obama's, but at least their heart, for the most part, is in the right place. The Obama administration got a concession from Congress that it wouldn't be a requirement of the agreement that Tehran renounced terrorism. I want you to think about that for a while. You know, okay, yeah, this agreement's cool so long as they don't renounce terrorism. And a week or two ago, I don't know if we're going to have the video up for you or not, but you can sure Google it. You can listen to the, you can listen and watch Barry in his own words. But in an NPR interview, he said, oh, no, no, we can't demand that Iran recognize Israel as part of these negotiations. They're separate matters. Really? No kidding. Wow. This isn't the school of negotiations I went to when I'm buying or selling a cow or a horse or a ranch or whatever. Rather remarkable, but not when you know what their intent is. And their intent is not good toward Israel, and their intent is very good toward Iran. And then, of course, we have Iranian rebels taking the port of Amman. Oh boy, this is a big mess. They now control the Strait of Hormuz, which is as good as controlling the Suez Canal and the world's oil supply, at least from that part of the world. And let's see, now suddenly Russia's cozying up to them. Do I see a naval base, an Iranian and Russian naval base in Amman, so they can control oil? And oil is a key to both their economies, and the price of oil is very important to their economic well-being. Gee, what do I see shaping up here? We're going to talk about that next week as part of this three-dimensional chessboard that Obama is sitting on their side of the table on, I might add. And then, in addition, Russia's going to sell their most advanced anti-aircraft missile system. I mean, this missile system can track 100 targets at a time. That's pretty phenomenal. Up to 25 miles away. That's a long ways. And all this is going to lead to something, folks. What do you think it is? I've been saying it for over a year and a half. I really believe that a first strike by Israel using tactical nuclear weapons, which is the only thing that can now penetrate these bunkers that Obama is allowing them to keep in these negotiations, is the only thing that can penetrate them. I think you're going to see that. I think you're going to see it sooner rather than later. I don't think Israel's going to wait for those Russian missiles to be installed. We'll see. We'll see. And then, of course, we have the spectacle of no money, again, continuing, going to our true allies, the Kurds, Ukraine, Jordan. No money going to them yet. No weapons going to them yet. Gee, who do you think Barry wants to win this struggle? Let me think. And then we have Greece melting down. Go back 2 years, folks. In fact, I'm going to have my producers put the link up for you. Greece is California. I forecast this. Once again, I'm not smart. It's just math. Water runs downhill. This is a huge blow up with Greece. We have an article posted under International just to show you how bitter this has become, particularly between Germany and Greece. Read that letter from a Greek resident, and you will know just how nasty things are over there in Europe. And we'll also give you an idea why they are frantically printing 1.3 trillion in euros, which we've talked about the last four or five shows, so that they can have their own quantitative easing program and buy their own debt, because, you know, America's such a great model of that with its quantitative easing, which is going to tank their currency even more and have consequences for the U.S. dollar at the same time it's under attack by China, Russia, and other countries. And the Asian bank is being formed by China. Listen to my show last week. And then we have our taxes, which came along April 15th, just a few days ago. Wow, when you see what these tax dollars, I'm going to go over this. I'm going to break down a dollar of tax next week. And you're going to see where it's going. And part of it is going into this immigration boondoggle, which, by the way, we have now learned 514,000 Social Security cards have been issued under this program already, and despite a federal court order, because Obama really doesn't care about the rule of law or the Constitution. That's not what he's concerned about. And we're going to go into that. And that leads us to the one thing I am going to go into some detail on today, because it's not something that can wait a week. But if you go back to my shows on immigration, four, five, 6 months ago, and I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out. You have open borders. You have ICE itself admitting that actually a majority of the people that are crossing the border are not from Mexico or Central America. Where are they from? Oh, you mean Pakistan, Iran, Syria, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Well, this just came out. I mean, this is like hot off the press late yesterday. Judicial Watch, which is a terrific watchdog group, and I mean, they get it right, and they take up the flag, and they've won huge court cases on all sorts of subjects. They research their stuff. They are not drum beaters. You can rely on their information. They might be one of the most reliable sources of information out there on the planet today. Judicial Watch has found out from a Mexican Army field grade officer and a Mexican Federal Police Commissioner, an inspector, very high ranking, that ISIS is organizing 8 miles from El Paso, Texas, in the Anapra neighborhood of the Juarez and Puerto Palomas districts, which is a huge druggy district. It's run by the cartels. It's very unsafe for the army and police, which, of course, is why ISIS chose it. And the area cartel control of that, the cartel is helping ISIS folks get across the border. The coyotes are now running ISIS operatives across the New Mexico and the Texas border, folks. Specifically, ISIS now has its headquarters in Mexico, in the cities of Santa Teresa and Sunland Park. Let me scratch that. They have their headquarters across from the New Mexican cities, which are near Texas, of Santa Teresa and Sunland Park. And they're kind of targeting the airport, the railhead, the bus system there to spread out a little bit further. That is a very porous border area on purpose. You know, this goes back to Mr. Obama and his minions. Between Ocala, and Fort Hancock, Texas. So, quote, these specific areas were targeted for exploitation by ISIS because of their understaffed municipal and county police forces, and the relative safe havens the areas provide for the unchecked, large-scale drug smuggling that was already ongoing. The Puerto Palomas-based cell of these drug cartels targets the New Mexico towns of Columbus and Durning for easy access to the United States. And the Mexican intelligence sources, by the way, also confirm that Islamic State, ISIS, intends to exploit, quote, the railways and airport facilities in the vicinity of Santa Teresa, New Mexico. There was a joint operation last week with the Mexican Army and federal law enforcement officials. Guess what they discovered? They didn't catch one ISIS guy, of course. But they discovered a whole bunch of documents in Arabic and Urdu, as well as the plans for Fort Bliss, you know, that big military installation that housed the U.S. Army's 1st Armored Division. And it's been reported that ISIS now has spotters across the border in the East Portrillo Mountains of New Mexico. They're assisting with border crossing operations, in other words, reinforcements. And they're conducting reconnaissance of regional universities, the White Sands Missile Range, government facilities in Alamogordo, New Mexico, Fort Bliss, and the electrical power facilities near Anapra and Chaparral, New Mexico. I warned ya, folks. And do we hear anything about that in the mainstream media? Do we hear anything about that from our Department of Homeland Security, who's busy frisking us down at the airports? How about from Valerie Jarrett, our Tehran, Iran, Muslim advisor to the President of the United States? No, we don't. Because, you know, the Islamic State is not Islamic, to use their words. But we're going to tie all this into for you together next week. This week, shall we, let's commemorate our beginning. Because there is strength in history. And the shot heard around the world, the shots fired at Lexington Green on April 19, 1775, that's tomorrow, changed the world. But a lot of people don't know exactly what happened that day. You've heard of Paul Revere, and you've heard of Lexington, and the militiamen, and the minutemen, and the British, and all that kind of stuff. Today, I'm going to give you the story, the real story, the confusion, the mistakes on both sides that led to America. So, let's start, shall we? The British Army, as you know, was called Redcoats. And they knew that there was a colonial provincial government. Two key figures being John Hancock, Sam Adams, and another one, John Warren. They wanted to capture these rebel leaders. They wanted to destroy the supplies of military stores that loyalist spies had told them were in Concord and Lexington. So they had a dual mission. However, in the porous sieve of intelligence that was Boston, in 1775, both loyalists, called Tories, and patriots, Americans, colonists, rebels, whatever you wanted to term them in the lingo of the time, there was really no secrets. And the Colonial Congress, who basically controlled the public, it was called the Department of Public Safety by the colonists, controlled really all the ground, all the lands, all the villages, all the communications outside of Boston, which was controlled by the British. And a year before, there was an incident called the Powder Incident. Now, nothing really happened in that incident. It's kind of buried in the history books. But what it did do was it prompted the, what later became the Colonial Congress, in this case the Department of Public Safety, the colonial government rather than the British government, to organize an alarm system. It included riders, it included people with sailing boats, it included all manners and sorts of things, bugles and drums and flares, you know, to spread the word far and wide and quickly. And they organized their militias into bands called Minutemen, which could grab their arms and stores enough for 3 days, enough ammunition and stores and clothes for 3 days in a minute, and be on the road to the point of conflict or defense. On April 14th, General Gage, who was commanding Boston, the Redcoat Army, which, by the way, was only about 2,000 men at the time, got word from his superior in England that the rebel leaders were to be arrested if possible, but for sure the military stores that the loyalist spies had told them about at Concord and Lexington needed to be destroyed. There was a tavern. There was a farm called Barrow's Farm. I mean, they had all the locations pinpointed. However, word of the orders to Gage were leaked out of England on a faster boat. You know, the old sailing boats. Some could cross the Atlantic 2 or 3 weeks faster than others. And for at least 3 weeks prior to Gage even receiving his orders, the colonists knew that something was up. The rebel leaders were moved from Boston to Lexington. The military stores in Lexington were dispersed to other villages, as were the military stores for the most part, other than 3 heavy cannon and some, really, 500 pounds of mini balls and some stores of salted pork were moved out of Concord. In fact, the cannon, which were hidden at a tavern, in a farm next to a tavern, were buried in the furrows along with some other supplies and planted over so that they couldn't be found. And the alarm system was abuzz. A man by the name of Dawes, and a man who has been lost kind of in history, and a man by the name of Paul Revere, who has become glorified history, were the two main dispatched or designated agents of alarm from Boston. Dawes was charged with sounding the alarm along a land route, and Revere along the sea route. And on the evening of April 14th, this is a week before, Paul Revere made his ride. It was not the night before. It was almost a week before. He made his ride, alerting the countryside, as did Dawes. And they slipped out of town, by the way, so early, including Paul Revere rowing a rowboat after curfew under the guns of the British frigate battleship, the USS Somerset, which would play a pivotal role later on, 2 months later on in the battle for Bunker Hill, rowed right under their guns, mounted up, and took the coastal road, sounding the alarm and literally stopping at every house. It's a pretty amazing story. But with this 4 or 5 day notice, nobody knew when the British were actually going to muster. Neither did Gage. The commanding general didn't even know. With that 4 or 5 day, the alarm was spread far and wide. In fact, by the time the British actually mustered, a force of 700 men, several companies of light infantry, and several companies of heavily armed marine brigadiers, on the night of April 18th, in the dark, at 10 p.m., on purpose, with troops that had volunteered and officers that had volunteered to lead the troops, a critical, shall we say, era that had unintended consequences for the British Crown, as I'll get into in a moment. The countryside was already up in arms. The alarms had spread as far as 25 miles, 40 kilometers from Boston. That was a long way in those days, folks. A long way. That was a 2-day kind of not stopping ride. It was a number of days march. Concord and Lexington themselves were about 17 miles from Boston. And as the alarm spread, it spread into the other colonies: Vermont, New Hampshire, New York, Pennsylvania. And Minutemen began to assemble from as far away as 150 miles, and began to march toward the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The British, of course, had no idea what was going on. They figured that this was going to be a complete surprise. In fact, it was only on the night that the troops were mustering at 10 p.m., that one of the field officers for Gage went out into the commons just to kind of feel what the attitude was out there. And when he was in the commons, he talked to a man, and that gentleman asked him, "When do you think they're going to be getting to Concord?" And that's when the British realized that they were already mustered. They were already crossing the river. They realized that they weren't going to have the element of surprise. And it was at that time, believe it or not, that Gage actually started to muster reinforcements. He knew in his gut, as a good general, that his men might have a problem. But he hoped they wouldn't. He gave strict orders that they were not to molest colonists. They were not to burn things. They were not to, in his words, loot and pillage. They were to treat everybody with the utmost respect. They were to pay the colonists for any food or drink or water along the way. The British desperately wanted to avoid starting a conflict. They knew they were sitting on a powder keg. And at the last moment, Gage reversed his orders and said, "You know what? Forget arresting the rebel leaders. Forget Hancock and Adams. Forget Warren." Because he was afraid that with the fact that this was no longer a surprise, that arresting those leaders would actually lead to a revolt. But as a soldier does, he followed his orders, which was to destroy the military, or to attempt to destroy the military stores at those two villages. Because Gage had asked for volunteers among his officer corps, and because those officers were leading men who were unfamiliar with each other. You know, there's trust that's built up in a military unit between the men who give the orders and the men who take the orders. And when you are, it's kind of like having a new quarterback in a football game, although much more deadly. Your orders are not followed quite as fast. There's some question when an order is given. There's some doubt in a soldier's mind. And all this would play into effect not only that day, which is tomorrow, but that day would play into effect with what is going on right now in your life. Anyway, the countryside was sufficiently alarmed that the militia at Lexington, although history doesn't teach this in most of the school books anymore, to the extent it teaches history at all, actually mustered as the British troops were mustering in Boston. There's various accounts, and it's pretty foggy, but it's generally agreed that there were 77 militiamen that mustered that night. And the gentleman who commanded them had a famous saying, which he in fact did utter. However, before I get to that, there's been glorified accounts of how the militiamen stood their ground at Lexington and, you know, they returned fire to the British. Actually, that's not what happened. Their commander ordered them to stand with unloaded rifles in parade formation out in the open on the commons and out of the way of the British, simply as a show of military force. He knew he was going to be outnumbered. He was related to more than a quarter of the 77 men that stood with him, and he did not want his men hurt. So the militiamen were standing there when the British arrived, early, almost at daybreak, just after daybreak, on April 19th, 1775. And there's various accounts of what happened. Many accounts think that somebody fired a shot, not from the British and not from the militiamen, but somebody in a house, somebody behind a wall. But whatever happened, the British, because they were not used to taking orders from their officers, when the shot rang out, which, by the way, hit no one, formed up in a loose column and fired a ragged volley, despite the screams and shouts and curses of their officers to cease fire, to not fire. And 8 militiamen were killed, several more wounded. The shocked militiamen, a few got off a shot, most ran. And the British troops thought they had a great victory, although the officers were nervous. They then delayed for several hours, critical hours, I might add. It's amazing how the slightest twists of time warp and decisions that seem to be so insignificant at the time. The officers actually let the British troops have breakfast while they reorganized their ranks and admonished them to listen to their orders, and wasted several precious hours. Because in those several precious hours, the news of what had happened at Lexington was flying through the country far more rapidly than the advance warnings of the British troop movements to begin with weeks ago. And men who had not even thought of picking up their musket, who were not really part of the Minutemen, but part of a much more loosely knit militia, kind of the National Guard in our parlance. The Minutemen were the ready response units, and the militia were the National Guard. It's the best analogy I can give you. Even those men who had not decided to pick up their muskets were now picking up their muskets from all around the countryside as news of the massacre of their countrymen at Lexington greatly blown out of proportion percolated from town to town, rider to rider, trumpet to trumpet, flare to flare, bonfires on tops of hills. And when the British reached Concord, it was a far different scene. In just a few hours, almost 500 militia had assembled, and several hundred more Minutemen, and they occupied the high ground around town. And there was a steady stream of arrivals. By some accounts, almost 100 an hour were coming in from all across the colonies. The British, of course, could clearly see what was going on. Well, not clearly, but they had an idea of what was going on. They dispatched one regiment. The commanding officer was by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Smith. And his adjutant, his second in command, was Major Pitcairn. They dispatched several companies down to Barrow's Farm to look for the arms there. Another several companies over to the tavern. They left one small company of inexperienced troops with officers that the troops didn't know at the North Bridge to guard the escape of the column to the Barrow Farm, and to make sure that the rebels, ever increasing in size, did not cross into town and trap them. What happened next What happened next is that the British at the bridge, guarding the bridge, with militia and Minutemen now on the high ground around them and beginning to advance up the road in a march. Their guns were not at port. Their guns were not ready. It was simply an attempt to kind of scare them off the bridge. The inexperienced soldiers, led by commanders they did not know, in this case a lieutenant who had never seen a battle himself, panicked. There was a shot fired, and then another, and the two militiamen out in front, one of the gentlemen by the name of Parks, were immediately killed. The Minutemen, better trained, and the militia, more loosely trained, returned fire, killing 8 British soldiers and wounding a dozen more. And the British cracked and ran. The other British across town heard the gunfire and came to reinforce. And the commanders immediately, was Major Pitcairn, immediately realized that, number one, his force down at the Barrel Farm was now cut off, and that there was an increasing number of Minutemen and militia, and that a battle had actually started, a real battle this time, not Lexington. He had lost men. Men were wounded. And their course of escape was cut off. I mean, it's really pretty fascinating. The militia and the Minutemen fell back. Their commanding officer, and it was kind of a, you know, in true American tradition, while there was one commander, there was actually a kitchen full of commanders. So every major move that the militia and Minutemen needed to make was kind of a consensus type deal. They were all from different colonies. They had different allegiances, although they had a common enemy. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. And over the course of the next few hours, as the British, once again, they stopped for lunch and to tend to their wounded rather than getting the hell out of there. You know, typical European combat. And in the meantime, hundreds and hundreds of more militiamen and Minutemen are arriving. The force is now up to 1,700. They now outnumber the British 3-1, close to 3-1. And the British finally make their move out of Concord, and the militia and the Minutemen allow them to come up the road, and they begin picking them off from stone walls and orchards and from high ground. Casualties mount for the British. Attempts to send out flanking companies to kind of clear the stone walls and the woods up ahead of the column are met with very stiff resistance. The colonists are losing some men too, but the ratio is lopsided. The column continues on. Redcoats getting picked off all along the way, wounded, killed. And they begin to run. The British actually begin to run down the road. In the meantime, more militia are coming in. There's now 4,000 Minutemen and militia. And command has been ceded to one central figure, who's an old hand at the French and Indian Wars. And he keeps his companies and his new men rotating up ahead of the British. He organizes a mounted brigade, the first cavalry of the United States. You know, how cool is that? The, shall we say, the embryonic tissue of the cavalry in Threads West. So the 1st Cavalry Company it was like 20, 25 horses of the United States kept ahead of the British. They would ride out, dismount. As the British would come around a corner, they'd fire a volley. They'd swing into their saddles, and they'd ride up the road again and wait for the British again, all the way down the road. The British suffered through this for 8-9 miles of grueling march. Panicked. Remember, these men had no faith in their officers, particularly as the day was going on. And most were inexperienced. Many of the British soldiers were throwing away their muskets. The colonists now number 5,000. A steady stream of men coming in by the hour. It's up to 200 men an hour reporting for duty and being sent by the commanding officers out ahead of the British column. So there were always fresh forces flanking the British as they moved. In the meantime, the reinforcements from Boston had finally gotten themselves organized. And along with two cannon, which, by the way, only had 5 shot apiece with them, they were organized for a light and rapid march, met what was left of Major, who had now been wounded, by the way. Major Pitkin's horse was shot out from under him. Major Smith took a mini ball through his leg. So all the field officers were down on the retreating British column. They finally met the reinforcements. And the commander, I'm not throwing out all these names at you folks because it doesn't matter. I'm trying to give you a story here. My producer's saying, give them the names, give them the names. You're not going to remember the names. The British commander, who was a savvy warrior himself, had fought in the European wars and had fought in the French and Indian wars, immediately realized what the colonists were doing. And he organized his cannons at the head of the column. And where it was critical, since they were so low on ammunition, each soldier was only carrying 36 rounds. That was nothing. That was 36 ramrods. You know, not much. And his cannon, which were low on shot, they only had side bags. They had no wagons. In fact, their supply wagons, this is a great kind of sidelight to the story. The two supply wagons loaded with ammunition and rifles and cannon and shot were way behind them with a very light troop of dragoons. And coming out of Boston, they were bushwhacked by a group of 60-year-old men who were too old. The Minutemen didn't want them in their ranks, and the militia didn't want them in their ranks. And by God, these old-timers, they were going to get in the fight. And they ambushed the supply wagons just on the other side of the river, within sight of the guns of the USS Somerset, I might add. And they ordered them to stop. The British didn't stop. They captured them all, killed the others, and captured the supplies for the colonies. Far more military supplies than the colonists had lost in this abortive raid that had gone so wrong for the British. And the day wasn't over. The reinforcements surrounded what was left of the retreating column, put them in the middle. And this general deployed a rear guard and his best, most highly trained and best armed men out front as a very strong kind of point of the spear. Every once in a while, the column would stop. The cannon would fire a shot up to a high hill to kind of clear the rebels off high ground. The fighting got especially intense, in fact, house to house. In two villages on the outskirts of Boston, Miriam was one of them. And the colonists suffered their greatest losses there, 25 killed. They were no match for British bayonets in close quarters. And the British, very angry over what had been going on that day, and kind of fed by their own rumors that British soldiers were getting scalped, began to burn things down, shoot innocent people, commit atrocities to get even. Once again, you know, some of the troops not listening to the commands of their officers whom they had never served under before. And as that happened, the colonists became more pissed off because word was spreading. You got to remember, the weaponry of the day was really only effective. The standard weaponry of the day was really only effective at 50 yards. 50 yards. It's 150 feet, folks. It's half a football field. So it wasn't like you had long-distance battles going on and long-distance communications. People could see what was happening 50 yards away, and they would shout it out back to the people behind them. I mean, you got to really kind of put yourself in the smoke and haze and confusion of the battle and what each side is telling each other and what each side is telling their own ranks and the way rumors get embellished and started. But it was hand-to-hand combat in those towns. And the British lost another 40 men, another 80 men wounded. This is a huge, huge defeat for the British. Hundreds of men killed and wounded. And they finally made it back. They finally made it back into Boston in the evening, limping, wounded, draped over the two cannons. There's newspaper accounts which are absolutely fascinating if you read about it. It's just fascinating. The rebel force had now swelled to 15,000 men from virtually every colony. And the British tried to set up fortifications on Breed Hill, which later they abandoned, and that became the site of the battle. Number one, they were reconstructed and completed by the rebels. But it became part of the Battle of Bunker Hill 2 months later. So the siege of Boston, in one day, from daybreak, when the shot hurled around the world was fired, and the commander of the Lexington militia told his men to hold fast, but if fired, ye shall fire back. And if there is to be a war, let it begin here. From dawn on April 19th until dusk on April 19th, your history, my history, and the history of the world was changed. Irrevocably, inevitably, and forever. And in the space of one day, a colonial force of 77 men standing with unloaded muskets in parade formation grew to a fighting force of 15,000, surrounding the largest city in the colonies and putting the British army, the most powerful army in the world, under siege. You know, those people are the people we come from. Their hearts are our hearts. Their dislike of authority, their hatred of tyranny, and their love of freedom is our own. And I thought it was important to recap that story for you. You know, it's part of that story of us. It's just 70 years, that's it, before the story begins again in Threads West. In the high mountains of the Rockies rather than the coastal lands of the Massachusetts colony. I think you'll agree with me, it's a great story. And I think you'll agree with me that it's a story, a great story that needs to continue. And I know you'll agree with me, listeners, when I tell you it is our job our sacred duty to continue what occurred in 1875 tomorrow, April 19th. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Enjoy tomorrow, the anniversary of the day the shot heard round the world was fired. We'll talk to you next week.